You're about to listen to the Complete Developer Podcast, the podcast by coders, for coders, about all aspects of life as a developer.
I'm Will, the curmudgeonly experienced developer.
And I'm Beege, the optimistic newbie developer.
Complete Developer Podcast is supported by listeners like you. We are now on Patreon at www.patreon.com/Complete Developer Podcast.
Welcome to another episode. This week, we're joined again by Cody Rockwood for a discussion on Tuckman's stages of group development. We'll start talking about group development and then delve into the five stages, talking about how each one is a necessary part of team growth. But before we get started, Will, what have you been fighting this week?
Well, I got a nice little stomach bug Friday, and so I came home and I dry heaved and did some of that Saturday morning and then decided, hey, you know, I'm already miserable, so I might as well go low carb, like get those two overlapping, you know, so I made some venison chili that was like hot enough that it's immediately started burning in my ear canals. And I made these protein bars that mostly don't taste like compost. You eat one, it gets rid of your hunger. You eat two, it gets rid of your constipation. They're great. So that's basically what I've been doing is, deal with the diet and all that kind of stuff. You know, work, we're still trying to roll our project out. You know, it's in front of QA folks and they're finding stuff and, you know, fast cycling, you know, editing things. So that's where I am right now.
How about you, Cody?
I would question your decision on making hot venison chili after being sick for 2 days.
That's what I normally eat, is hot stuff.
Because you just want more just... terrible, like
it didn't bother my stomach at all.
Oh, okay.
Actually, you know, but apparently the jalapeno peppers I got were like really good ones. You know, sometimes they like they vary.
Yeah,
and it just man, my eyes are watering. I mean, I got through a whole big thing.
Sounds like you're asking to be sick, but
nah, I feel great.
So I've been moving from a different, moving into a kind of a different role where I'm on more enterprise type services and looking at the broader vision of where we're going, everything from a payment gateway adjustment to handling our customers from kind of an enterprise level to looking at middleware and how we're going to do reporting on all of our disparate apps. And it's been fun. I've gotten a lot of the stressful points taken away from my job so that I can kind of focus on what I enjoy doing. And then I just let BJ have to deal with all the terrible stuff and customer interaction and
unfun, he's a good crap catcher.
Unfun things. Yeah. He's told me before how much of a crap umbrella I've been before, and now I just get to like walk away and watch it rain. So that's been a lot of fun. It's been good not having to be stressed out all the time.
And you know, you get all that free time to watch those Rick Astley videos.
Yeah, you will get payback for that.
So we are right at the end of a sprint. And we're kind of just going over some stuff on our Slack channel today on, you know, what to do after you click submit and where what to show. And so I posted, it's like, oh, we should do something like this, Rick Astley.
Yeah. I thought it was going to be some kind of cool transition technique or something that was actually useful. And
what's hilarious is I had forgotten Cody was in that because he's not on that team anymore. And I'd forgotten he was even in that channel. Yeah.
I'm in all channels.
And the person I was trying to actually Rickroll got around it thanks to YouTube's ads.
Yeah.
So, but I've been working on two different teams this past week. One is closing out a project and with kind of the finishing the final bugs found in QA and getting ready to hand it off to the customer. Whereas the other is just getting started. We're about to finish our first sprint tomorrow. And we're building the team relationships and all that fun stuff during our first sprint. Specifically, I've been dealing with some IIS issues and getting the API working. Setting up new projects isn't really something a developer does every day.
Nope.
Well, IIS stands for Internet Issues Server, actually.
Yeah, okay. That explains issues, a lot.
Because yeah. I've been dealing with them today, too.
So we just started alternative workspaces and remote work today. I got to work from home the first time under this. Got my machine upgraded to Windows 10. Woo. That took about half a day last week, so that was a lot of fun.
I don't know why they have to use AWS as the acronym for it. It really bothers me.
Well, nobody else is using it.
Yeah, I mean, nobody big like Amazon or Microsoft.
Yeah,
anybody.
No.
Yeah.
Not at all.
And it doesn't, I mean, like the real AWS doesn't go down either, right?
It's, never. Ever.
Never has a problem.
I've been having some fun issues with the upgrade to Windows 10. And speaking of that, I got something Windows 10 related for IoTs.
Is it Edge?
You would wish. Let's go ahead and roll the music. This week for IoTs, I have a fun little project you can do with Windows 10 Core. It's an ultrasonic distance mapper. This project creates a radar-type device using ultrasonic distance sensors and a servo. Now, distance is typically measured with sound or light, infrared usually. These sensors measure distance within 80 to 500 centimeters. Radar requires a rotating sensor, hence the servo, and the servo is controlled by an Arduino, and the sensor by Raspberry Pi running Windows 10 Core. I'll have a list of the hardware and software components in the show notes. So, Will, who's talking to us this week?
Got a iTunes review from Raker? Ray KR?
It's Ray KR.
Yeah. As a self-taught programmer, I'm finding this podcast immensely valuable and interesting. I finally get to learn some of the whys and theories behind best practices that I'm sure I missed out on by not studying CS in school.
Thanks, Ray, for the comment. Be on the lookout next year for my book on computer science for the autodidact, or self-taught coder, where I cover a lot of these topics and a few others that you would get if you had a degree, but those of us self-taught programmers may not have learned. Send us an email with your address, because we have a Complete Developer water bottle just for you. And guys, if you'd like your very own Complete Developer water bottle, leave us a review in iTunes, or comment on the website or any of our social media. We post all our episodes to Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Google+. We're also on Path and Tumblr. I want to take a moment right now to remind y'all that our friend Bethany Adams has released her second book. So to celebrate, we're running another contest where we'll be giving away an autographed copy of one of her books. It'll be the winner's choice. We'll be announcing the winners the first episode in May. To enter, just leave us a review on iTunes. We love seeing those 5 stars.
So just a reminder, Cody is a lead front-end developer and designer with the state of Tennessee. He's been building websites for a little over 8 years, 3 of which have been with the state. Before that, he worked as a freelance developer and designer.
That's right. And I wrote the outline for this episode. I didn't quite go full med student on this one, but I did go all out grad student, which is okay.
He dissected it, not dissected it.
Oh, nice.
As the concept comes from psychological journal articles, yes, I did read the articles when writing this outline. My graduate research was on anger management of female athletes in team sports, so the topic had some relevance to me. I was also drinking margaritas when writing it, just like grad school. The stages of group development were originally proposed by Dr. Bruce Tuckman, PhD, in an article he wrote in 1965 called Developmental Sequence in Small Groups. Dr. Tuckman was a psychologist who conducted research in the area of small group dynamics. He started his career as a researcher for the Naval Medical Research Institute in a think tank setting looking at small group dynamics for small crew vessels, and finished his career as a professor at Ohio State University. While most of his research focused on education and college students, his stages of group development have been used in many industries where small groups work together towards a single goal. In the original article, Dr. Tuckman states that team growth and dynamics are influenced by the setting in which the group is working, the area where the group behavior falls at any point, and where the group is in the sequence. He originally wrote about 4 phases of group development: forming, storming, norming, and performing. And then in 1977, he added a 5th stage called adjourning. Dr. Tuckman states that they are all necessary for a team to grow and work together. So we're going to go through all 5 of these stages, kind of define what each one is, discuss what Dr. Tuckman actually says about them, and then talk about how they relate to Agile and Scrum, as well as some issues that face the team during that stage. Hey guys, I just wanted to invite you to come out and join us June 1st through 3rd for Music City Code, Nashville's hometown tech conference. Music City Code is packed with workshops, seminars, and panel discussions to inspire progress in Nashville's tech community. Music City Code will be held at Vanderbilt's Surratt Student Center Thursday, June 1st through Saturday, June 3rd. Ticket prices are half price through May 1st, and if you refer a sponsor, you'll get a free ticket. To learn more about Music City Code and register for the conference, visit musiccitycode.com.
So the first stage is forming, and this is the initial stage where the team meets and learns about the project and agrees on goals. Most team members are positive and polite, although some may be anxious or excited to get started. This is something I've run into a lot with teams. Like, it's sort of like the early phase of Jurassic Park. You know, like at the beginning, you know, everybody's clapping and happy, and then later there's running and screaming. This is, you know, this is when they're landing the helicopters.
The awe is still there. Yeah. Everybody's still trying. They're trying to figure out what they're getting ready to get into.
Yeah. And they're all on their best behavior because they don't know the other people,
and they're not stressed.
Yeah.
And there's not water under the bridge. Usually.
I don't know about best behavior.
Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting, too.
They're not on their true behavior.
So, this whole, like, the whole concept of the four first ones, I've never heard of the fifth stage. But even if you've been on the team together before, if you've split up and you are reforming, even though you know the person or people, you still have to go through these stages. And it's strange. So, like,
it's like getting back together with an ex.
Yeah, it does kind of have that tone sometimes,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, so that best behavior line is kind of why I kind of cut in there, because you're not always on your best behavior. You just haven't made anybody mad yet.
Yeah, or you're not on the behavior that is the behavior that will continue throughout the project.
Well, that best behavior statement has more to do with a brand new team that has never worked together before.
Sure, okay, that makes sense.
So we should kind of put that in context is... Some of what we're going to talk about is going to be teams that are reforming.
Yep.
That is a stage, and we'll talk about this later on, that Dr. Tuckman didn't talk about, but has come up in other research, is the idea of teams getting back together, or the same people being on a different team, and that is a reforming of the team.
Sure. It's kind of like the second honeymoon.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's what this is the honeymoon phase. Everybody's happy. We got put on a team. You know, we're getting ready to go off into this great, wonderful project and all the awesome things we did or will do.
That's true. You also see a lot of your mature members modeling the appropriate behavior for the team.
That's something else you don't always see.
Mature members, not older.
Okay.
Mature.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you gotta clarify that, because you'll get the cranky old programmer is going to probably be crankier.
It doesn't mean that they're mature.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes they kind of fall down on it. Like, people are trying to shape the context for the team during this period. So, you know, leaders are picked. People try to figure out what other people know. And so some people will go at that from a perspective of, okay, I've got to be kind of gruff and standoffish so that people realize I'm in charge, or people defer to me.
That makes sense. The other thing is the environment you're in plays an important role in setting the tone and behavior.
Right, because if you bring people together and it's a crisis-type situation versus, okay, hey, we're doing a new product, we're starting a startup.
Yeah.
And so we're all going to meet for beers and, you know, like, talk about ideas, and you're going to be involved in all this. Like, the set and the setting matters a lot. Because if you start it that way, yeah, it's going to go positive. If you start it as, hey, this thing was supposed to be released a month ago and we don't have specs for you, but you're on the team for it, and oh, by the way, like, four people in the office are getting prosecuted if this isn't done, that's a different tone.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely going to matter, you know, the context of the project you're getting thrown into and that kind of thing. But I don't know. It's strange. I've looked at, and this kind of jumps ahead, but I've looked at a lot of this. I did not know there was actual research around these names. BJ had to kind of highlight it for me when he started doing some research. I've heard of these terms for years. I've been involved in team building in a lot of different aspects of my life, so I've heard of these things. Now that I've actually seen the research and kind of gone through it, there's a lot of pieces I don't really agree with, because I don't feel like they're real world contextual. Like, there are things that don't really work out when you put people together. You know, part of the forming stage, in my opinion, is kind of what you were saying, Will, is where people start jockeying for position immediately, day one.
Yep, I do.
That's because the roles and responsibilities are usually not clear.
You're right.
At that stage.
And you can't remember everybody's name and what they do. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and it's even little stupid stuff like who gets the good chair or who gets the cubicle that's in the least annoying place.
I can't say I've been on that team, but.
Oh, I have.
Well, this is also a time where the established leadership has a stronger influence on the group.
Right.
The group is usually not making decisions for itself. They are looking to, you know, managers and team leads to make those kinds of decisions, those kinds of divvying up workspace type stuff.
Yeah, and the cliques haven't formed, and yeah, all those things that you come to expect from human society are not there, because you're basically dropping people in that mm-hmm. are, give or take, strangers.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of unknown. You're going to see a lot of your leadership be more used to being decisive. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be just naturally more capable of saying, okay, we are going to do this, or we are going to pick this path. Maybe your path hasn't been determined. So everybody's just kind of standing around on the island, looking around, going, well, which way are we going to go? This trail. That's kind of mm-hmm. where you see your leadership kind of step forward, because they're used to doing it.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Tuckman describes this phase as orientation, testing, and dependence. And says this is where members of the group try to discover what is and is not accepted by the group, which we'll kind of hit on. Yeah. Boundaries are also set by the reactions and responses.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those places, like when you're on a new team, like you have to set that. You have to set the tone of how you're going to be interacted with. Because if you don't, you're going to have a bad time later.
No. Members are tasked with identifying the relevant parameters and how the group will accomplish the goal.
Yeah. It's my experience that forming tends to go pretty quick, very short term.
Yeah. And like in relation to, say, Agile and Scrum, this tends to be around your Sprint Zero or your design and planning meetings.
Yeah.
The team is first getting together, meeting each other, discussing what they're going to be building, finding out about the project. That could even go into the very first sprint.
Yeah, I mean, I think Sprint Zero is definitely the time when you kind of have that, like I said, it's that honeymoon, you know, phase where you can kind of say, okay, well, this is the great product we're going to build, and you're learning about it, like you said.
Everybody's getting their machines set up, making sure they've got all the pieces they need.
Yeah, you haven't.
Real basic stuff.
And you haven't directly interacted. You haven't had an opportunity for conflict, because everyone's still having fun.
Well, and nobody has anything to conflict over, because crap doesn't work.
Right.
Some issues facing the team are mainly around orientation to each other and the tasks at hand. And yeah, a major function of this stage is getting to know your team members. And there's a lot of fear of the unknown during this stage.
Yeah, and this is like the absolute worst time to bring your lunch to work every day. Because you really need to go out and socially interact with your team.
Unless everybody brings their lunch to work and you all go eat together.
And I hadn't really ever thought about it, but that's a really good point. The teams I've seen be most successful, especially recently, you know, eat lunch together, interact together, do things outside of, you know, not necessarily outside of work, but just kind of together. They'll go get coffee together, and you see them assimilate together really fast.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And get used to each other really quickly. So that's actually a really good point. I've not thought of that before.
Well, it's like training a horse, right? You're around it a long time, walking around it before you put the saddle on it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Sure.
Otherwise, you get kicked in the face.
Well, it's some trust there, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is where people are learning what's expected of each individual member, what's expected of the team as a whole, and how the other members are going to react to these expectations.
Sure. And I think it's really important to kind of note that leadership, not within the team, but above the team and kind of just around the team, needs to understand that for them to be successful, they need to have that correct instruction. You can't just throw a team together and say, you're going to go do this and hands off. Mm-hmm. Especially during these first phases, you're going to have to be there, be hands on, and kind of help guide the ship to the right place so that they, like you said, they understand what's expected, adjust early. You know, if they start heading down the wrong path, they can adjust kind of early. It helps them understand those expectations. So leadership is a little bit more hands-on at this point.
I will add one thing, too, though. If you're dropped into a team like that that doesn't, you know, they go, oh, y'all handle it, and it's hands-off. And like, let's say you're the manager that's saying, okay, y'all just handle it. Your replacement is the guy that organizes that.
100%. Yeah, 100% agree sense. With that.
Yeah. So it's dangerous from a management perspective to do that anyway.
As a manager, you want to be a certain level of hands-off, because you don't want to micromanage. When a team is forming, that's when they need you the most to be in there managing. Right.
Well, yeah. And most people forget to pronounce the miss in micromanage, because it's micro-mismanage.
Yeah, that's true.
Usually. Because it's somebody that doesn't know how to value their time appropriately telling you how to value yours.
Mm-hmm. yeah, I like that. That's good. The next phase is storming. This stage of group formation starts when members begin to push against the boundaries that were set up during the previous stage. It usually starts when members notice differences in each other's working styles. Some members may feel they are taking on more work than others, and assumptions are made about the work habits of other members.
Yes. Like, oh, here's somebody that, you know, they should be here till 5 and they left at 4:55. When that, like, it's almost like the first guy that notices that and verbalizes it, it's like a crystal in a super saturated solution. Like, everything else just gloms right onto it. Like, the rest of the crap starts once that first one goes. Because that's when everybody else realizes, hey, it's okay.
Yeah. It's open season at this point.
Yeah.
I've been quiet until now, but if they're not going to be quiet, I'm going to say what I need to say.
Yeah.
Which is, interestingly enough, I'm generally the first person to say something.
So am I.
Because
you might as well control the timing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
because it's a process that's going to happen no matter what. It's sort of like an explosion, right? If you control the timing of an explosion, it's a demolition. Otherwise, it's a mine.
Yeah. That's very true. Well, you know, Cody, you probably remember this from when I first started, because we had another back-end developer that worked with us that had not done the web API type stuff very much.
Oh, yeah.
And
took me a second.
She had been there for a long time, and I just assumed that she knew a lot more about that than I did, but she knew more about like classic ASP and a lot of older technologies that I still don't know much about. But I was expecting her to be at her level of knowledge on those for web API, MVC, that kind of stuff. And I was getting very frustrated when she was not at that much more advanced level.
Right.
And it was basically, you know, I brought it up to you and you were the one that was like, you know, this was kind of a little bit of storming in our team on that. And you pointed out to me, you're like, look, you know, this is new to her too. So.
Yeah. I mean, and it's funny, I was in that leadership role there. So, you know, a lot of my perspective is going to come from that. For whatever reason, I usually end up leading teams. It's strange how that happens.
You are a lead developer.
Well, yeah.
You're that normal.
Yeah, but that
that's what it is. It's like we can put you in front of the suits and they don't get creeped out and go, yeah, let's just fire these people.
Yeah, well, there is some of that. I'm not going to lie.
And it really doesn't take much to be normal, because I am.
Well, and it's normal, but it's also being willing to make those decisions. But yeah. I mean, it was pretty easy to identify that your frustration was from an expectation that wasn't getting met, but the expectation itself was flawed, because we were moving into a new way of building apps altogether. So, of course, you couldn't know that. You were brand new and getting kind of set into that. But I think it was, you know, that's one of the ways that we kind of solved that particular issue. There were many during that project. The storming phase went for a lot longer than it really should have.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that was due to lack of communication. But I think between you and I, you know me, I'm really direct. You ask me a question and I'm going to tell you exactly what it was. You know, the particular developer that you're talking about had to adjust to my style of communication.
That's true.
That's a nice way of saying they cowered in the corner and shook themselves.
No. Storming is one of those phases that's really, really necessary, but it's something you want to get through as fast as possible. And you can do it. You can go through it faster when you have people on the team who are empathetic and can understand kind of from the meta what's happening.
Another way that this can come about is through challenging leadership.
Yes, especially like with infighting, or, you know, you get like a little clique of people that go off to the side and go, oh, this, you know, this manager sucks because they drop the F-bomb 5 times during a meeting and all that, which, you know, I mean, we've got a manager where I work that does that. And it's like, that's how you know, like, he can get mad at a situation versus getting mad at you. And it very easily gets interpreted as him being mad at you, but that's not what's going on. Mm-hmm. And early on in this gig, I actually, you know, had an interaction with him like that, where I thought he was ticked off at me. You know, I mean, yeah. I thought I was about to get fired, and he was just mad at the situation. I was just the guy working on that project, but the project was a dumpster fire and had been for 3 years. And he was mad because of how much money had gone into it, you know, trying to get it put together.
In my opinion, you know, your manager who drops the F-bomb and just runs off on a tear during a meeting.
He's not the only one, though.
But he's like a good manager that understands that about them. It's kind of self-awareness. You know, you have that tendency to do it. You then kind of have to follow that up, especially with the new people who don't know you, and say,
right,
by the way, not mad at you. I just hate that we're here.
Right. And it was, I mean, the other team members actually explained it. They're like, oh, yeah, yeah. forgot to tell you this.
Yeah. So,
and I was like, well, you know, that's great. You know,
was it he who shall not be named that forgot to tell you this?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, he didn't forget to tell you
that. He wanted to see me squirm. Yeah.
He did.
So, see, that's... Yeah. Well, that's great.
It's building camaraderie.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, it was something that took a little bit to get my head around that, mm-hmm. hey, like, this is just, you know, this is a management style, and there's a certain set of norms around this, because the other thing you can do is you can go right back at him, you know?
I can see you doing that, too.
Yeah. And that's fine.
Yeah.
And, you know, he appreciates when you do. Like, there's been a couple things he said, oh, we should do this. And I'm like, that idea is bad. Like, that's a terrible idea. And I go, okay, why? You know, we can go from there, and it might get a little loud, but
anybody that's going to be in an environment where teams are a regular thing, you're going to go through these phases. Part of that culture to help you through these phases is communicate openly. Always, even if you're not sure, ask, say something, say, hey, you seem like you were really mad at me today. So, was that a thing? Or, you know, and just ask them, just straight, yeah. You know, every time that I've seen this happen, quickly asking in a very concise and direct, method to say, hey, are you mad at me? No. Okay. Well, then what was all that about earlier?
Yeah.
Just don't shy off in the corner. Like you said, crawl up in a ball and crawl into the corner and cry and all that.
Yeah, because that doesn't fix anything.
No, it doesn't. And they just cause them more, they cause themselves more stress, and it builds up until there's a bigger issue or something like that.
So, Dr. Tuckman describes this phase as resistance to group influence and task requirements. Members of the group become hostile towards each other and leadership, which we've discussed. Group members resist the formation of structure by infighting and uneven interactions.
And that's an issue that you really have to be careful of, is the uneven interactions. Mm-hmm. You know, make sure people are getting included. You and I have been a problem before when, you know, we'll exclude someone from the group, or when you and I will just sit down and kind of hash it out because we work really well together.
Yeah.
And it causes an issue. We have to, and I think we've identified that before.
Yeah, we have.
And this is especially bad in teams of three.
Yeah, it's
because you'll have two on one. And
That's what happened to us, was because you know, and most of our listeners know how inclusive I am when it comes to getting stuff done. Cody and I could sit down and just get it done.
Sure.
Yeah.
And
well, you're very direct and you're like, okay, what's the fastest way to get us where we're moving?
Yeah.
And then you go move. And people that don't have that approach are going to get, like, you have to consciously fight to keep from sidelining those people, mm-hmm. just because you're like, I got to get stuff done. I don't want to sit here and...
Yeah. And that's that's what happened with us.
Because I had that same problem.
That Cody's referencing. So, yeah. You know, and the other thing is members tend to react emotionally.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they resist demands placed on the individual from an emotional standpoint.
Yeah.
And this relates to Agile and Scrum. Usually in the first sprint or the first Scrum stand-ups, you'll see typically when the team starts working on something together.
Yeah.
Is when like Will said, those false boundaries.
Yeah, or the false assumptions.
Down. Yeah. Those start coming down when the work starts happening.
Sure.
Well, I mean, I've had the interaction with people that are like, why do you cut up and, you know, make fairly harsh comments and stuff, you know, when it's a friendly environment? They're like, wow, that just, you know, people are going to be scared of you. I'm like, no, look, if people are not surprised, they're usually not offended. It's when you break the expectation, that's when stuff shatters. And so, like, having a little bit of an edge, not a bad one, but just a little bit where people go, okay, he's kind of a smart aleck, and I know that. That means that if I accidentally slip up and say something that's a little too far, it doesn't surprise them and hit them like a truck. They're like, okay, it's Will.
Yeah.
Whereas the guy that's always really nice and deferential and stuff, when he says something slightly cutting, it's an HR incident.
Yeah.
And if I'd said the same thing, it would have just...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, a few issues, and we've talked about some of these already, facing the team, are that personality clashes can bring work to a complete halt.
Yeah.
There's also no real strong ties to colleagues at this point. They don't have that strong relationship for support during the stressful times. Because this is when you're building those relationships.
Yeah, you don't have shared history.
Yeah.
And shared conflicts and things that you've gotten through, because those are about to happen.
Mm-hmm. And you don't have an established process for dealing with
Yeah, and you don't know like what somebody else's weird tics are or what they're like. He who shall not be named, he'll say, "I hear what you're saying," and what he actually means by that is, "I hear what you're saying, and I wish you'd shut the up."
Yeah,
you know, and like once you recognize that tic, it's like. Okay, you know, like the there's not going to be any further conversation.
Actually, this way. When he says, "I hear what you're saying," what he's saying is, "You're speaking, and I really don't care."
Yeah, that's what I meant. But you know, you start to recognize those things, yeah. And you know, like my boss recognizes that when I start pulling pranks on people, that I'm stressed.
Yeah,
because that's what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, like, and you know, you mentioned. You don't know each other and that kind of stuff. And I know we're going to talk about reforming a little bit, but you know, when you've been on a team before with somebody, and you have kind of some instant clickiness, because it always happens. You have your favorites. You have to be careful. The team has to be careful and conscious of excluding people just because it's more natural and normal for others to hang out or others to work together or others to, you know, if you have some history, even if your project's apart, you remember what it's like. It's not like we go into a vacuum when we go to work.
Right.
You know, you've still communicated and you've still kept those relationships up. You're going to naturally kind of form up those cliques, and it's really important to recognize it as an individual and include your other people. And then you also need to pay attention to the fact that if you haven't been on a project team with this person for, you know, 6 months, maybe they've learned some new stuff. Maybe they've changed their communication style and adjusted. So what worked in the past may not work right now. So you're still going to go through your storming phase and have to relearn.
Or they went through a divorce.
Something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh, that'd be rough.
Yeah. When you pop back onto a team with somebody that has, I mean, I've seen people have complete behavioral changes.
Sure.
Out of that, just out of the shock of, you know, whatever that was. I mean, I worked with a guy that was alcoholic and, majorly obese and wasn't super motivated, went through a divorce. And like the next time I ran into him, he was telling me about the ketogenic diet and how he'd taken up meditation and all this stuff. And I'm going, nothing I know works with you anymore.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and you got to be aware that can happen. And it can also be little subtle things too that. So it's definitely worth being very careful and not making assumptions. The other thing that gets me is junior devs. Like the guy that you said, okay, you're on your first project with him and it's his first project ever. Like you'll mentally put him in a box and you get on another project with him 2 years later.
Yeah.
And it ain't the same dude anymore.
Nope.
Nope. No, that I can totally see that.
And you know, they'll start throwing stuff out and you're like, I didn't know that existed.
Yeah.
Because while you've been, you know, kind of secure in your knowledge, that guy has had to be learning and has picked stuff up.
Yeah. That makes perfect sense. The other thing is even within the same group working in the same project or on the same tasks, this stage can be re-entered. For example, if new members come in or different challenges that they haven't faced before come up or different disagreements or people have life events like, you know, imagine being on the team with that guy when he was going through the divorce and making that change in personality.
Yeah, I've seen that happen too.
I can imagine that was a constant restorming.
Yeah, of course, I've also been on teams with dudes that were like all cranky and stuff, and then they like the papers fly, and then they're like, you know,
they're the best people to ever be around. You know? Yeah. I've been on that
side.
They're
singing in the rain, you know, so you just never know.
Yeah, I cut loose of an ex, and everybody was like, why are you such a normal person now? You used to be a jerk. I just hated being around you.
Yeah.
I cut loose of my boat anchor.
Makes a difference.
That makes sense.
So after that comes the norming phase. And that's the stage where everybody starts to resolve their differences and actually really start to work things out. That's where people begin to take responsibility for the success of the team as a whole versus kind of being an individual and just going, okay, I'm going to get mine.
Yeah. It starts to be team oriented. It starts to be like, what are we going to do? How are we going to get things done? You start replacing me and my with, you know, we and us.
Yes. And you'll actually hear that change in verbiage.
Yeah. And that's kind of a key, you know, from leadership and that kind of thing. When you're watching your teams, pay attention to how they're talking. You know, you use verbs consciously, you use pronouns consciously or subconsciously, and you'll change, you know, what you believe and what you think.
Well, the other thing you can do as a leader too is you can actually bring it along when that's going. You know, when you're in the storming phase, a lot of times if you phrase things a certain way, other people tend to ape that.
Sure.
And they'll kind of follow what they're saying Like most people will say things before they mean it, and then they go, "Oh well, like you know, I've got to be."
Yeah, you start thinking
coherent team. With what I said.
You start thinking in a team. Team, you know, I was told a long time ago when you start talking about need versus want.
Yeah.
When you say I need to do something, you know, you have less of a tendency to do it than when you say I want to do something.
Right.
Same kind of thing here when you start talking about, you know, oh, well, I've got this work to do and I'm going to accomplish this or whatever versus we have this work to do. We're in this fight. That changes how you think.
Yeah. Tuckman describes this phase as openness to other group members. And it's the point where you start to accept the group and the individual members of that group. Figuring out ways that everybody can work together is, you know, the highest importance at that point. And actually, I think he has a quote here somewhere.
Yeah, I do have a quote. Harmony is of maximum importance. Well, that's directly from Dr. Tuckman. Members tend to develop an open exchange of interpretation of the tasks or goals of the group. Like there is that dialogue, that communication that was the problem, or the lack of that was the problem in the storming phase, is now an asset to the team.
Yeah, and this is fairly similar to the retrospective period in Scrum. It's the point of going, okay, what went wrong last time, what went right, and then it's getting that feedback loop basically going.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, right. It's the feedback loop. It's the, you're no longer looking at, you know, any kind of what you felt like were personal transgressions between one another, and you start looking at more of, okay, this is what we accomplished, and we either succeeded or we failed, and I'm not being, you know, blamed, but the leadership is looking at all of us. So,
yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. Not only am I taking a hit here, but everybody else here is taking a hit. And it's kind of that whole, you know, we argued for 6 weeks and we just lost. And look at, we still, you know, I'm still in trouble.
Right.
I thought I was right, but I'm still in trouble. So maybe I need to get, you know, out of my own head and out of my own ego and start figuring out how we're going to work together.
Right.
Yeah. This is where the storms of the previous phase are discussed by the group and solutions found.
Yeah, typically. Sometimes they're not verbalized, right? It's a thing of, okay, I don't need to bring that up.
Yeah, you start to overlook some of the more annoying things that some people will do.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's kind of like being in a relationship. You know, you learn to like it, I guess.
Or you learn to not hear it.
Yeah, you know.
Yes, you learn to like it until the project is over with, and then you can complain about all those idiosyncrasies that you at one time had learned to like.
Yeah,
that's the way relationships have been with me.
But. Yeah, the bad thing is when you start complaining before the project's over. I mean, that's the biggest risk here, right?
That's when you start going back into restorming. Yeah, this is also a point where teams become more comfortable enforcing their own rules. Members start holding each other accountable. The other day, this new team I'm on, one of the other team members who is typically quiet and shy, we had agreed as a team that we would call each other out if we got off topic during our daily stand-ups. And
sounds amazing.
Yeah, it is. it really is, because
he's not fooling around either.
Yeah, yeah. This guy, you've worked with him for a longer than I have, and he did, and it was not rude at all. It was a, hey, this is off topic. We said we were going to call each other out on it, and it can be handled after the meeting. And then another thing, like I said, this is a quieter, more introverted person. When the scrum master was out sick, he stepped up and led the meeting.
Right.
And I was a little surprised by that, but I was like, I'll let you do it. I'm not going to fight you over this.
Right. But if it's something you wanted, I mean, that's,
yeah.
You know, these are some of the places that you'll start to see, you know, after you've been through enough teams, mm-hmm. When you pay attention to these phases and you kind of understand what's going on, you'll start to see where the conflicts can happen and you can kind of head them off the path. You can, you know, for instance, you can take that back roll, that step back and kind of say, mm-hmm. Okay, well, if he's going to take this on, there's no need for me to take that on and be completely comfortable that someone who is your peer or a junior to your position can take a role that's almost feels leadership styled, but you're still okay with it. You're still comfortable with letting them handle it.
I think that's also part of personality thing too. It's a maturity thing that you start to realize you don't get threatened by people, like you said, who may have a junior position to you taking on leadership roles. you start to take, like, hey, I know this person, and yeah, you're proud to know them.
Well, the other thing, too, from a management perspective is if you don't have somebody, you know, below you that can move up into your job, you can't move into your boss's job.
That's either. True.
And so that chain has to be maintained to pull you up.
Yeah.
And
on another note, with this particular person we're talking about, there have been times where he's pulled me aside after, you know, I've interacted with QA specifically.
Yep.
And has told me, you know, hey, just to let you know, you know, that what you said could have been taken as confrontational because you said it this way. Which most times I appreciate. There have been a few times where I looked at him and said, I know, that's why I said it that way.
Yeah, and that goes hand in hand. Being able for you two to have those conversations, and he's an incredible asset because he does this for me too.
Yeah.
But being able to have those situations where someone can call you out on that helps you.
Oh, it does. And this is part of the norming phase is, like, he can call me out on stuff.
Right.
Because we're on a team together, and I know him, I'm comfortable with him. And if he calls me out on stuff, I take a serious look at what I just did.
Right.
And that's where I'm going with this, is okay. That is part of this norming phase, is that as a team, we work together to where I know you well enough, I respect you well enough. Like, if you called me out on something, I would, you know, I might argue with you about it, but I would step back and reassess it.
Yeah, I mean,
because our personalities are argumentative, and
we've had those discussions where you'll come in the next morning and go, you were right, and I'll just say, yes, I know, and I'm glad you see it my way. No, but I just kind of say, yeah, you're good, no problem.
Yeah.
Well, and everybody has to be able to enforce their boundaries to be healthy too. So the norming phase is basically saying that, yeah, there's still going to be conflict, but it's not going to boil over into something that actually disrupts the team.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
That is the whole purpose of the norming phase, is you have and are learning to deal with those conflicts in a productive manner.
And some team members are going to go through this together a little bit faster than other team members.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the team as a whole needs to be aware of what's going on and understand that communication may be great between, you know, you and I, or something like that. But then when we throw Will in the mix, there's a problem. Mm-hmm. We need to be able to actively pull Will in, tell them the issues, work through it, and hopefully, you know, not cause a restorming situation. But
that's exactly what the biggest risk during this phase is. It's regression to storm. It's when, like you said, some members of the team get along really well and, you know, they get through that storming phase fast and they get into norming and they're moving along, but other members aren't. And that conflict between
the two groups.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the group that's got their stuff together starts to resent the group that doesn't.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the group that doesn't starts to feel like the group that does is in a clique and doesn't want to hang out with them because they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a recipe for everybody getting right back into it, because it's like a bucket of crabs. Like the people that don't have it together will pull the people down that, you know, do, essentially, you know, at the group level. What?
The analogy.
The bucket of crabs.
The bucket of crabs.
Yeah, I mean, you caught, I was going to say you caught crabs at the beach, but that's not a good way.
Hey, who hasn't caught crabs at the beach?
But if you take like a bunch of like blue crabs on the beach and you put them in a bucket, when one of them starts actually pulling themselves out, another one will try to climb out.
This should be more familiar to me because my family originates from Eastern Shore, Maryland. And when we went back up, you know, I've lived here my entire life, but when we went back up for vacations, I mean, they bust out bushels of crabs. I just don't remember ever seeing one yanked back in.
Yeah, they'll do it.
Crawfish do the same thing, but
smaller buckets.
The next phase, and the final one in the original four, is performing. And this stage is reached when the team works without friction to meet the goals of the project. Now, the structure and process of the team interaction is set up. Members are competent and knowledgeable. The team is autonomous and usually makes its own decisions about its processes.
And this is right at the point when upper management reworks the org chart on average. It's like, hey, things are too calm. I'm not managing.
Yeah.
I have to show I'm doing something. Like, there's always that guy.
Yeah, because you've got a lot less supervision that's required on the team. You know, the leadership still participates, but they take more of a backseat role. And the team itself makes most of its decisions. Tuckman describes this phase as constructive action, where the group becomes a problem-solving instrument. The members take on roles that will enhance the activities of the group, and the effort that had been previously used for group interactions and for getting along with each other is now placed on task achievement.
Yeah, you start to understand, you know, really when you, well, you have, you fully understand how team members are going to react. You understand when someone says something, what they actually mean by it. You're not guessing. And you spend less energy on that versus how are we going to get, you know, X done? Or I really don't like the way we're doing X. Can we do it this way? Yeah, actually, that might be faster. Those kinds of things start to show up where you have that kind of open dialogue without judgment is really the best kind of place that you can be. Yeah, the org chart usually.
Yeah, well, and the part of the deal, too, is that you start to have team members who they don't necessarily act out of their own benefit, but it's more like, hey, how do I increase the team's throughput by how I do things? And so I think a lot of times what happens is people start being, you know, their leadership capabilities actually start being seen. And so that will move stuff around just because management goes, oh, well, if they can do that, then, you know, we'll put them over here.
Yeah.
They see a team of three or four really successful people working together. So they go, oh, well, let's take this team and let's put each one of them on a different team that's not doing well because they'll bring that.
Yeah, because it's basically the thing of like functional behavior is a contagion, and that's not how it works.
Actually, quite the opposite.
Yeah, because then what you end up with is four broken people. And the next time they get on a team together, they've already been through a whole bunch of crap with bad teams. And so now you can't reform a team around two of those people either because there's going to be cliques and there's going to be all the problems. You know, because you basically structured it where they got burned.
Yeah, I mean, and your performing is going to persist for a while. So it's not like just on the project. So one of the things that, you know, we're kind of targeting at work is maintaining teams, you know, for two projects in a row and then maybe breaking them up. And that helps you kind of avoid having to constantly renorm and deal with all the issues that show up there.
Well, it's like constant refactoring otherwise.
Basically.
All the churn.
Yeah, basically, you're constantly reworking what you've already done, and you're not making any progress. Yeah, I really like the breakup of definitely when you start sticking those people over there on the other teams and just expecting magic to happen.
Yeah,
and then management standing around, you know, 3 weeks later, and they're going, I don't understand why these people were working so great over here. Now all of a sudden they're on these teams and everybody's mad. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. I don't understand why I took, you know, this corn from this growing field and threw it in a swamp and I don't have corn. That's effectively what they're doing. It's like, yeah, it's more the environment than it is the thing that went in the environment.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's a big, big, big thing for management to really understand. This doesn't, you know, you don't get to just throw your corn in a swamp and expect, look, the plant's going to change and just flourish.
Yeah.
This particular phase relates to Agile and Scrum through a successful sprint. You know, this is when all stories are completed with extra time in the sprint. You know, fewer bugs are found in testing and QA. You have streamlined stand-ups and scrums. You cover the relevant materials, which just as a reminder for you guys that if you haven't listened to our episode on Scrum or our Fragile episode, a stand-up should be what you've done, what you're doing, and what impedes you, and that's it. Non-relevant issues are not part of the meeting. These are streamlined, and this is those really successful sprints where your developers get done a few days early, and QA has time to go through everything and regression test everything and regression test the regression tests.
That's a little much, but yeah. But yeah, I mean, you start to understand as a team when you're in a sprint environment, you understand your velocity. Mm-hmm. You can feel what you're capable of. You probably understand your product a little bit more in your direction. So it's easier for the team as a whole to kind of look at the situation and say, okay, well, this is going to be a problem. Let's put it off on its own, you know, sprint, and then we'll deal with it versus when you're originally entering those sprints, you're like, oh yeah, no big deal. We'll just, well, this is easy.
Yeah.
You know, you'll hear those terms get thrown around, easy, and we just have to do this,
yes.
You know, early on. And then when
I've learned not to say those words, thanks to you.
That is correct. But when you're performing, you kind of naturally understand that things aren't easy. It's very rarely just, and you can anticipate those issues as a team. And you start, that's why you start to see, in my opinion, that's where you start to really see your performance. And it's not necessarily because we're faster or better. It's just we understand what we're capable of and we commit inside of that playground.
Well, we can also project too, like what's going to happen. You know that, okay, the team members respect each other. So if I go, okay, let's do it this way, you're going to actually listen because we've already been through how to, you know, like I know how to talk to you, you know how to talk to me, and I'm not sitting there going, okay, well, how do I approach him about this? And let me think about this. You don't like fart around and spend that time on that.
Right.
So you can actually go execute.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that makes perfect sense because, for example, we're finishing off a sprint. And so tomorrow we have our product review, retrospective, and sprint planning for the next sprint. So today I was going through the backlog, looking at the items that we're going to be committing to in the next sprint to make sure I understood them and things like that, because we are a little bit ahead and I had time to do that. In that, I realized, hey, this one story, now it looks like it really needs to be broken into two stories. So I sent an email to the team, and my initial thought was, send it to the scrum master, say, hey, split this into two stories because blah, blah, blah. And then I thought, wait, you know, that's probably not the best way to handle that. So I sent the email to the team and said, I think this story should be split into two stories. And the response I got back was from the scrum master, hey, you're right. That really should be two stories. I'll go do that right now. And then another member was like, yeah, I agree. That really should be split. And it was something that it wasn't much storming on that particular issue early on, but it was something that through group interaction, I realized the best way to handle this was send it to the group and like, hey, this is what I found. What do y'all think?
Sure. And that's experience that's teaching you that.
Yeah.
Which going through and it's being conscious of, you know, before understanding these phases, maybe you wouldn't have realized how much it matters to not just cut, you know, cut into the BA and say, hey, or the scrum master, that's what we call them. But, you know, being able to get to them and say, hey, I need you to put this together. Going to the team matters. And it allows them to have that opportunity to put that in, you know, to give their input. So it just makes them feel better. So there's less of a conflict.
Oh, yeah. And even if they agree, they don't feel like they were left out.
Right. Yeah.
That was my thing was I was writing the email and it hit me. I'm like, you know, if one of the other members sent this and it got done and I wasn't included in the conversation, I'd be upset.
Yeah, I've never seen you more frustrated typically than when you find stuff in the backlog that you've never seen before and you have no idea what it is.
Yeah.
We've experienced that enough in the last project, and usually it you know, involves you hitting your chair, potentially hitting a keyboard, muttering some expletives, just quiet enough for me to hear them across the cube wall, but no one else can hear them. And then I just kind of chuckle to myself and say, BJ found a gem, and leave it at that. But, you know, it's frustrating. You're right.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want that to happen to me. And I think part of norming and part of performing both are realizing I don't want other people to do this to me, so I'm not going to do it to them. You know, I hate to pull like the golden rule type thing, but I mean, it's one of those things where if you set the example of, I'm not going to do this, you start setting the example for the team.
Right.
Some of the issues that face the team during the performing phase are lack of supervision can cause regression into earlier stages. You know, we talked about how the management takes more of a step back during this phase. A lot of times, like Will said, they'll split the team up because they say, oh, they're being successful. So we've got four successful people. Let's put them on four different teams to make those four teams successful.
And let's penalize them by moving them all into management while we're at it.
Yeah.
Yeah, or that. Yeah, you're now lead of these other teams.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Despite them having any kind of leadership or not.
Mm-hmm. Right. Just because you can shovel horse poo does not mean you can drive the trailer.
Exactly. But the other thing is over-supervision can lead to underperformance. When you have supervisors and managers micromanaging, or as Will says, micromismanaging.
Which is really the only kind.
Yeah. It's interesting that you bring up the splitting the team up, because that's not something that came up in the research I did.
Yeah.
Because none of the...
That's experiential.
Yeah. Well, this is where the academic research falls apart, because they're not looking at what a company actually does with...
Right. They're looking at intent. And they're also looking at what happens to academic teams.
Yeah.
Because they don't move very much compared to free and market.
Not all of these are academic teams, because this... The original research came out of naval teams.
Right, well,
small groups.
Yeah, you probably still have a lot of that, you know, even there. They're going to have a bias in their research towards the way that a team is structured. It's kind of a Conway's Law thing applied to... You're familiar with Conway's Law, right? It's the structure of an application developed by the team will mimic the communication structures of the members of the team. And this is the research that is produced by a team mimics the structure of communication of the team doing the research.
That makes sense. Also, let's be honest, it's easier to research a team throughput from start to finish than it is to research what actually goes on, where management sees, oh, this team is performing really well. We've got four high performers here. Let's split them up. That's not easy to do research on.
Right, because too many variables.
Yeah. Also, changing circumstances, such as new team members.
Resource management issues.
Yeah. Can cause regression to norming or even storming phases.
Yeah.
We talked about that.
Well, I mean, look at what we dealt with, you know, around Christmas. You know, when you were getting pulled one direction and I was getting pulled another because we were having resource issues. And, you know, when we came back together, some things had happened in our project and... you know, you and I didn't really have issues, but it was, there were some kind of knockdown dragouts, you know, in a couple cubes and during some planning meetings and things like that, when we were trying to get started back up, those never really got resolved even to today. But you know, those things can happen when you start having resource management. I mean, those are very real world situations. Like we talk about the management stuff, you know, if you're needed on another team to save them and bail them out for, you know, maybe you've got a client about to leave or you've got some project that's about to fail, you know, scramble and mess stuff up. You know, you're talking about maybe saving one project, but what's the cost of losing that performance phase on the other project?
Mm-hmm. That's true, because we were at that point in time in a performance phase.
Oh yeah, I mean leading up into Thanksgiving, we had gone from 35 points as an average velocity. I was gone the 2 weeks before that, and y'all hit 85 with down a member. Mm-hmm. So exponential improvements, and then everything went south, and I mean it went south to the point where the project completely failed. We had to scramble for a month, and then you and I had to go on our death march last month.
Yeah.
That sounds familiar.
And it was actually a very similar situation to what you were talking about, where we weren't exactly pulled completely off of it, but we were pulled to go save other things.
Yep.
Well, it still changes the team dynamics, right? It does, because the people on your team don't necessarily 100% believe that, okay, you're supposed to be working 15 hours a week on this other project, you say. Like, unless somebody goes to them and says, yeah, he's supposed to be on that 15 hours a week, because they may go, well, he's supposed to be on it 10 hours a week, so he's just farting around the other five, because they don't know.
Yeah.
Right.
And when people don't know, they make all kinds of stuff up.
Yeah, which you start finding your regression.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's when you start finding the resentment and some of the things that were tucked away neatly in their closet and everybody was behaving. And then all of a sudden, here we go, doors start flying open and people start getting attacked.
Well, people start moving too. Yeah. Like they start jockeying for position again, because you have a strong team member that gets pulled off, or a weak team member that gets pulled off. Yeah. Either way, somebody's going to start jockeying around, because the guy that's the least effective on the team, or the second least effective when the least effective leaves, they don't want to be at the bottom.
So the final phase is adjourning or mourning. And this comes about when the project is complete and the team is broken up. And that's something we've kind of been talking about during the performing phase, is, you know, the team getting broken up and put on different projects. Most teams will reach this stage eventually, because a lot of times project teams only last for a fixed period of time. And even permanent teams may be restructured during organizational changes. You find that teams that are really good at the performing phase may be split up to go out and help other teams, not realizing that it was actually the team structure that caused that.
Yeah, and well, and it's the dynamics of the team.
Yeah.
I mean, it's akin to thinking that you know, a chemical reaction will be the same if I switch out one of the chemicals. It doesn't really, that doesn't follow.
Yeah, it's like, you know, changing out. Well, I mean, you could change one salt for another, but that doesn't mean you're going to get the same response.
That's what gets overlooked.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is the retooling time that they don't think about. It's like, okay, yes, this person is successful in this project that they were in for 2 years with a team that was static, give or take, during that time. Mm-hmm. And they know each other and they like each other and they've worked through all the crap. Let's throw them over here into the, you know, great unknown, and we're going to assume the same level of productivity is going to come out of them, and that just doesn't happen. It falls through the floor. It's sort of like taking somebody from a civilized environment and throwing them on a desert island by themselves. You're more likely going to get Lord of the Flies than you are a, you know, unique city-state with high tech.
In this sort of adjourning phase, members tend to have mixed emotions about the conclusion of the project. You know, there's some sadness at the disbanding of a team, especially if they have been a tight-knit group that's gotten a lot done. Yeah, the reward for working well together and working hard is we're going to split the team up. But then there's also some excitement at finishing a project, like the one that Cody and I have talked about that we're very glad is coming to a conclusion.
Yeah, finally.
Yes. And there's also some anxiety or fear of starting on a new team. I know some of that was dismissed when we started working on a new project because Cody and I were going to be on the same team. And then he got pulled off for other stuff, and someone else that I had worked with before was put on the team that other team members had worked with. And so we didn't have near as much anxiety because we knew what we were getting into a little bit better.
Yeah, but there was some. I remember you actually, it was interesting. I like I said, I did not know about this fifth phase. And looking back, I've seen it and I saw it, you know, when I got moved away, because we had been talking about, we had kind of carried on that performance phase right straight into the new project. We were already planning out how we were going to accomplish things. We were excited about how we were going to, you know, push forward and really make an impact. And then I got shifted around, and I remember you saying one day, which kind of made me laugh and kind of step back at the same time. You were like, but you're not going to be on the project anymore. I was like, yes, so? But I like working with you. Like, that was the, and I think the other, you know, the other developer that you're working so well with now had not been placed yet. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you knew who you were getting. And I think you were reaching, you were reaching back to some of your other options thinking, well, this might not be as fun as we had anticipated. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see some of those things.
Well, it can also be a little bit nerve wracking too, especially when you're at the beginning, because you don't know, you don't necessarily know that you do well. In that environment, like you don't have a large enough sample size to go, okay, I do well at development projects being thrown into a new team. It's like, I did well this time. Once you've done that, you know, 20 or 30 times, you almost start to get a little bit eager to jump in and do a new project. So it fades over time for the most part.
That makes sense. Yeah. And Dr. Tuckman describes this phase as disengagement. The group here is concerned with disengaging and ending the relationships, kind of bringing that to a close.
I mean, I'll be honest, it's been hard for me, you know, not being able to kind of continue working with you. It was, you know, like I said, we were really excited about moving into the next phases and of different projects. And, you know, I'm on things that are completely different now. And really, I'm not even on a team. And losing that environment and being on my own is not as much fun right now. It is largely less stressful because I don't have a team project and other things to do. I get to focus on my work, but at the same time, there's some camaraderie and things that we had built that disappeared. And you don't realize that those things aren't fun and that you'll miss them until it's gone. So it's something to just kind of be aware of as you're moving through these phases.
There's something about commiserating over the difficulties.
Oh yeah.
You're going through.
Yeah.
You know, like, the nice thing is because, well, up until Friday, you literally sat right in front of me.
Uh-huh.
We could still go to lunch together and stuff and, you know, talk about things, and you understand what it's like to work on a team.
But I'm not as familiar. I'm not engaged. I'm not I'm not in it.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, there is in a lot of teams a sense of sadness at the separation and even some self-evaluation as to, you know, hey, what did I do good in this team and what did I not do good? You know, like I've tried to do that myself moving on into this new project and go, okay, I don't want to make the same mistakes that I made in the previous team. So, I mean, yeah, you know, like with what I mentioned earlier about sending out that email, including everybody, you know, that was one thing that you and I struggled with was when we got on a goal, we had trouble bringing in the other developer. And so I've made a specific effort to try and include everyone on the team.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, anyone that goes through these processes should walk away with a knowledge of what to do in the future to make things easier. You know, if you're not walking away with that, you're doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, clearly. So I would expect, you know, any developer that's on my team or, you know, that I'm managing at some point, you know, to be able to go through these phases and learn from them. And they'll have new storming reasons. They'll have new issues in the next projects. But like you said, you're able to take that knowledge and kind of, to me, part of mourning is kind of assessing what you've gone through and kind of understanding the ups and the downs. You know, it gives you that small, short period to kind of process it. And then carry that forward into your next forming.
Then group members after this period tend to experience positive feelings towards each other and leadership. They tend to forget about a lot of the storming that went on.
Yeah.
At least emotionally forget about it.
Yeah. They might remember it happened, but it doesn't, it doesn't hit them the same because the other stuff is piled on. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. To me, that's like I relate that to the drive to vacation. When you're back, you know, everybody hates the drive there.
Yeah.
But when you're back and everything's over and you're thinking back about the vacation, how many times does anybody complain about the drive there? Yeah. Very few.
This is why you buy a motorcycle and ride it there, because the ride is what it's all about.
That's what she said.
So this relates back to Agile and Scrum, kind of the sprint review, or even the handing off of the product at the very end. Kind of on the small scale, it relates to the sprint review because you are at the end of your sprint. You know, the team feels a sense of accomplishment and, you know, members of the team may be changed between sprints. You know, their capacity may be reduced on your team for them to work on something else.
True.
And other members who were not on that sprint may have more capacity for the next one.
Yeah, possibly. They'll be more engaged in certain specific tasks, things like that.
But this mostly happens at the end of a project when the team hands off the finished product to the product owner or the customer. You know, we're going through this right now at work. You know, we've just finished building something and it's had like a little over a month of QA. We had a few weeks where the dev team was completely dedicated to fixing bugs. And then as we've moved on to other projects, we've come back and spent a day or two each week working on it.
Yeah. But it's been interesting to see that transition. You can kind of start to see some of the mourning occur as you're fixing those last bugs and those last items, knowing that even though we're so ready for this to be over, there's a part of it that you're going to miss.
Oh, yeah. And there, you know, you get to understand the product and the project really well. And so you're going to miss being that subject matter expert.
Sure.
On that level, you're going to miss, you know, there's going to be things that you're going to know. I wish I could have done it this way. I wish we had thought about this that came up later on. Or I know for me, there's a lot of things that only during bug fixes, I've thought, oh, if we had designed it this way instead of the way we did, we could have done this and this and this.
It's better than thinking, if we had designed it, we could have.
Well, that's true.
I've had a few of those come through where it's like, yeah, we just kind of shot from the hip here and it scaled faster than we thought. And yeah, we're kind of screwed now.
Yeah.
That's a lot worse.
Yeah, but I mean, you've been through those times when you're thinking, when you're looking back at the full product and you're thinking, man, you know, I really wish
the way that works.
Yeah, I really wish I had time to go fix that, or we're going to have to, you know, people are going to use this product and there's these nitpicky things in there that I really don't like, but I just can't fix them. I have to move on.
Yeah. The product I'm working on right now has got a few of those that are things that are like little bitty, you know, it's like, oh, I just want to change what's the data that's displayed here, but you can't do it because the way it's coming from three or four different sources and none of the data that you actually need is here in this pipeline and it's used by 10 other things. And, you know, you can't fix it. It's just like, yep, it's going to be that way.
Right.
Unless somebody really, really wants to pay for it to be changed.
Right. Part of that mourning phase is really kind of understanding the project is coming to a close and these things are just not feasible to accomplish.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly.
It's like what you run into at the tail end of a piece of writing too, because it's like, okay, I'm now abandoning this. I can't polish this any further, even though I should.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Sure. And that makes a lot of sense. You know, saying abandoning, sometimes that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
You just launch this thing out into the wild and you may never look at it again. Next time it may be a completely different team and you may not be involved. You know, you like to think that you did your best, but knowing that there are things that you can fix and that you could do better.
And knowing that other developers in the future are going to be looking at your check-in comments and mocking your skills on some sections. Yeah. Like, you know, because when you have to hack crap together that just barely works, what I hate is like you have to like duct tape something together to fix it so that you can keep going. And then the stuff around it that caused that problem gets cleaned up. And then yours is left there just like a little turd.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's the worst, because you know that somebody's going to look at that, you know, 5 years from now and go, this guy was awful.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, this guy was in a situation.
Yeah.
That's why we have this thing at work called Cody Says.
I forget how this started.
We put in the comments, Cody says, this sucks, fix it.
Yeah. So now all the comments are going to say, Cody says. So when we search for comments that need to be fixed, it's not to do, it's not whatever, it's Cody sucks. At least on the front end application.
Yeah. Because he kept saying, he's like, well, do it for now, but put in there that we need to fix it. Or he'd put in a couple of things where, hey, this needs to be changed. And so we made the joke that, you know, Cody says this needs to be changed.
Yeah. So now that's throughout our code.
Yeah.
It'll be great in 5 years from now when people are saying, who the crap was this guy?
Yeah.
And why is he across all of the applications? If he knew they sucked, why didn't he fix them?
All of them.
All of them at once. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Because he knew they sucked. So he should be able to fix it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So a few issues facing the team are that members can find the stage difficult. They like the routine. They like doing what they know.
Yeah, people and fear change.
Yeah, they do. They also develop relationships. Yeah, even if at one time they were very stormy and very difficult and they couldn't wait to get away from those people, they're still going to miss it.
Typically, yeah.
I was gonna say, I'm not so sure about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, because I've been on a few teams like that too, where it went through the stormy phase, and what it ends up with is it's sort of like, after a while, things settle, but it ends up settling into something like the married couple that stays together for the kids. Yeah, those people are still glad to get away.
And sometimes it's a matter of, even though the person is glad to get away, they still miss that interaction.
Yeah, sometimes people miss really dysfunctional environments too, because they can be dysfunctional and be like, yeah, I'm not even the worst one here.
Or they're just used to it.
Yeah.
It becomes your new norm, and you adjust to it. You know how to adapt to it.
Yeah. Most critiques of Dr. Tuckman's stages state they are too linear, as groups move in and out of different phases at different times. A group with members that have worked together before may start informing, then move to norming and performing without hitting storming, but then have a setback, then brings them back to storming or even renorming. Timothy Biggs suggests rearranging the stages so that norming comes after forming and then again after storming before reaching true performing. This kind of relates back to what Will was talking about on how in the forming stage you kind of set those false boundaries and then storming breaks them. Well, you set them in forming with Timothy Biggs' idea, and then you have a norming phase where you're using those false boundaries before hitting the storming phase. Then Robert Bale suggests that group members seek a balance between accomplishing tasks related to the project and building interpersonal relationships. Whereas early on, building those relationships is more important to the individual members, and towards the end, accomplishing the tasks is more important. And eventually they reach that balance. No matter the order or composition of the team, all small groups go through each of these phases in the process of working together. The trick is to continually be producing while the team is in the process of moving up to performing. And that about wraps us up. Before we close everything out, Will, what do you have for us this week for Tricks of the Trade?
Well, I want to talk about something I said earlier about conflict, specifically when you can see it coming. There's a lot of times where you're better off just going ahead and precipitating it. And the reason is usually people's resentment and anger at the loss of control and having to sit and stew in something tends to be a lot worse than the things that actually cause the conflict. So I would say probably 85% of the time you're better off just to go, head straight into it and actually go deal with the situation immediately than you are to sit back and wait. And it's kind of counterintuitive because, we all learn in school, you don't argue and you don't do this because, that'll lead to a fight and then everybody will get in trouble and, all this kind of crap. And you get the same thing from your parents, like with arguing with your siblings and all that kind of stuff. They don't want to hear it. So you're told to, kind of bottle it up. And I would say most of the adults that I've had to deal with have in some form or other been damaged children. And I include myself in this category. You learn things as a kid that are not necessarily applicable ways of getting through conflict. And one of those is being conflict avoidant. And this is, I think this affects shy tech people a little bit more than everybody else, especially when there's the social awkwardness. But I want to encourage people just in general to, if you can see a conflict coming, to, if you can't head it off, to go ahead and light it up. Typically, you'll be better off just going ahead and pulling the band-aid off. That's what I've got.
Stand by for Titanfall.
If you have a question or comment for us, please email us at neckbeards@completedeveloperpodcast.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from Stand By for Titanfall by Pure Bells, available on SoundCloud and licensed under Creative Commons. The intro music for IoTs is Hillbilly Hip Hop by Jason Belcher. For references, show notes, and to sign up to our email list, be sure and check out the website at CompleteDeveloperPodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at CompleteDevPod and like our page on Facebook to keep up with the news about the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time.